You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, we talk to a neuroscientist who says there's something to learn from the Amish community about immune health and mental health.
First, after Congress was sworn in this week, the GOP kicked off its effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act. Both Vice President-elect Mike Pence and President Obama held private meetings with fellow party members about the health care law that affects millions of Americans.
With Republicans in the majority, Democrats would have a hard time defending the law, and there are also plenty of questions about what will happen if Republicans do successfully repeal Obamacare, namely, what would replace it.
Rachel Bate is covering the battle over the health care law. She's the congressional reporter for Politico. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
So where does this effort by Republicans to repeal and replace Obamacare, where does it currently stand?
So much of the first week back in Congress, we're hearing a big messaging war going on Capitol Hill right now. As you mentioned, President Obama and Vice President-elect Mike Pence were on the Hill yesterday rallying with their respective parties. Basically, what we're seeing is they're trying to get their bases and their lawmakers revved up and trying to center on a message. Pence came and talked to Republicans about telling, quote, the truth to your constituents, which is that, according to him and according to Republicans, Obamacare has already failed. And they're talking about premiums skyrocketing, people being unable to pay for health care, basically saying that Democrats were the ones that screwed up the health care market. On the other side, we're seeing, obviously, President Obama talking with Democrats, trying to encourage them to protect the law as much as they can and to go out to the public and say, you know, if your health care goes bad from here on out, it's Republicans' fault. It's going to be their fault if things collapse. And they coined this new phrase that we're going to hear over and over and again, make America sick again, obviously drawing on President-elect Donald Trump's Make America Great Again.
It seems as though part of the difficulty for Republicans is that there are the rising premiums on the one hand. On the other hand, there are popular aspects to the law, like parents being able to leave grown children on their insurance until age 26 and protection for people with pre-existing conditions. So how would they plan, do you think, to weed out some of those but maybe leave in place more popular aspects?
So President-elect Trump and Republicans here on the Hill have both said that they're interested in keeping both of those provisions you just mentioned, the part about youngsters staying on their parents' insurance until they're 26 if needed, and then also the piece about pre-existing conditions and making sure people with severe health problems are not locked out of the insurance market. The issue we're having right now is Republicans have been talking about replacing Obamacare for years now, but they haven't put forward a specific plan, and that's what we're all sort of waiting for. We probably will not see their plan for a couple of months yet. However, we did get some news from Speaker Paul Ryan today at his press gallery. He talked a little bit about how their goal is to actually have this replacement plan done by the end of this year, which is pretty ambitious given that we're already seeing some Republican infighting on what this is going to look like this week, the first week of Congress.
What are the sticking points of the disagreements so far among Republicans?
Well, the first disagreement we're seeing sort of explode today on the Hill has to do with the budget. Basically, Republicans, before Trump is inaugurated, they're going to pass a budget. And basically what it would do is it unlocks a fast-tracking procedure that will allow them to repeal the law without any Democratic votes. And they need this tool in order to repeal it, right? They're trying to do it in the Senate, and there was one Senate Republican, firebrand Rand Paul, who said he's not going to vote for this. And the reason he said he's not is because he doesn't like that the budget doesn't cut enough money. Most Republicans on the Hill are saying, well, we'll worry about that in our next budget. This budget, we just want to make sure we can get that fast-track tool to repeal Obamacare. So what Rand Paul did when it looks like he's not going to be able to hold this up in the Senate where enough Republicans will vote for it to unlock the tool, he's going over to the House today to try to convince 45 House Republicans who are part of this rebellious House Freedom Caucus to vote with him to oppose the budget. And if they do that, they could pretty much stop the whole repeal process in its place. Now, I personally do not think that the Freedom Caucus is going to stand together to block this budget. If they did so, you can bet Donald Trump would be tweeting at them. Then there's going to be political havoc for them. They'll have constituents angry. You're blocking Obamacare repeal. I honestly just don't see that happening.
We're talking with Rachel Bade right now, congressional reporter for Politico. She's with us to give us the latest on what's happening on Capitol Hill as Republicans get underway trying to repeal Obamacare. And we were talking about visits to the Hill yesterday from Vice President-elect Mike Pence and President Obama. Do we know what President Obama had to say to Democrats yesterday? You talked about messaging. Did he have any tactical strategies for Democrats?
Well, tactically, Democrats are pretty much resigned to the fact that they can't really stop this. As long as the House and the Senate both pass this budget and unlock this fast-tracking tool like they're trying to do in the next couple weeks, they can pretty much repeal it. So what Democrats have to do is they have to become expert messengers, and they're pretty good at that already. So what you're going to see over the next few months, you're going to hear this phrase over and over again, make America sick again. Republicans want to make America sick again. And basically what they're going to be doing, you're going to see a lot of outside groups, probably a lot of outside spending, advertising against moderate Republicans whose constituents might be mad if they lose their health care. Democrats are going to try to pin any problems with the healthcare market on Republicans. So it becomes a messaging battle. And with that, what they're trying to do is build a grassroots movement that will basically stop the repeal and the death of Obamacare. But whether or not they'll be able to do that, that's going to be an uphill battle. I mean, I think that Republicans have been saying they're going to do this for years. And Trump, clearly, this was a huge platform that he ran on. And I think stopping that effort in its tracks is going to be very tough for Democrats.
Now, under the Affordable Care Act, the national uninsured rate fell to a record low of 9%. Given that, what are the major faults that Republicans would like to correct with a new system that they come up with?
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the insured rate going down, because today at his press conference, Speaker Ryan was actually asked about, will Republicans replacement insure as many Republicans or as many Americans as the current system under Obamacare? And he pretty much deferred on that question and started talking about something related but not really answering it. Republicans have never said that they're going to insure as many people as Obamacare currently is. However, when you ask them, well, what happens to those 20 million people who have Obamacare right now? Are they going to lose their insurance? They always say, we are not going to sweep the rug out from underneath people. So we're hearing a little mixed messaging here. Republicans, we know some of the things they want to do with health care. One of the big ones they've been talking about for years is allowing people to buy insurance across state lines. Right now, it might surprise some people who don't follow health care policy, but you can only buy insurance that's in your own state. So that limits competition, which in theory would have prices higher. They think the idea of having you purchase insurance across state lines will drive prices down because Americans can pick any insurance company in the entire United States, which allows for more competition and, you know, more money in their own pocket.
What happens to healthcare markets as this shift begins to happen? We know it would happen over the course of years, but is there concern about what happens to the markets in the meantime during this era, which is bound to have at least some degree of uncertainty?
Absolutely. One of the things that we're hearing a lot of healthcare experts talk about and worry about is what happens when the Republicans repeal this. Let's say repeal is not going to take place for 2 years, which is pretty much the plan, 2 to 3 years. So say, you know, we're in June and the Congress has just passed a bill repealing Obamacare at the end of, you know, say 2018 or 2019. Will the health markets, will the insurance companies bail on the marketplace, the Obamacare marketplaces that are still continuing for 2 years? Should they do that, and a lot of experts think they will, insurance prices are just going to climb and totally skyrocket even further beyond what they currently have been doing. And that means that people on Obamacare, the whole idea behind Obamacare, affordable health care, will pretty much just unravel, and insurance, buying insurance on the marketplace, if these insurance companies are bailing, is going to be impossible for these folks who are low income and, you know, turning to this system to try to make sure they're insured.
And Rachel, just very briefly before we let you go, what is President-elect Donald Trump's role in all this as it unfolds?
So we learned yesterday, Mike Pence told Republicans that Trump on as early as day one, but more likely in a few weeks or months after he's inaugurated, is going to be doing some sort of executive actions to ensure a smooth transition of repeal. We're not really sure what that means at this point. It was the first time we had ever heard that Trump could potentially sign an executive document without Congress to make his own changes. Now, whether that is, shutting down, the insurance, the marketplace for Obamacare, or doing something with taxes or the individual mandate right now, if you don't, get insurance, you have to pay a steep penalty tax, maybe he gets rid of something like that. I mean, it's unclear what that looks like, and I think we're going to be finding out more what he could potentially do on his own in the next couple of weeks.
Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Rachel Bade, congressional reporter for Politico. She joined us to give us the latest on what's happening on Capitol Hill as Republicans begin their effort to repeal Obamacare. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it was quite a start to the new congressional session this week. We'll talk with Representative Ron Kind of Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District.
First, the National Alliance on Mental Illness says that about 1 in 5 American adults deal with mental illness each year. As scientists and doctors try to get a better handle on things like depression and anxiety, there's a growing body of research that says that there could be a link between the immune system and mental health.
Western medicine has a history of looking at the mind and body separately, but our next guest says the connection between the two becomes clear when you look at one community in particular, the Amish community. Eric Hasseltine joins us now to tell us more. He's a neuroscientist interested in body-mind medicine. Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Well, on your blog, Eric, you wrote about some new research that looked at, and before we get to mental illness, we're going to stop at asthma and asthma rates in the Amish community, in one Amish community in particular. What did we learn from that about our immune systems?
We learned that in our first year of life, it's important to be exposed to so-called old friend bacteria that are representative of the ones that we had back in evolutionary history before civilization developed. So these are various bacteria, fungi, viruses, and associated toxins. And in the modern industrial world, we're too clean. So kids don't get exposed to this. And the immune system is a lot like the nervous system in that it needs to be trained with exposure to the environment in order to be able to cope with that environment. And so if you don't get that exposure in about the first year of life, your immune system has two problems. One is that it overreacts in some cases, such as asthma and other inflammatory autoimmune processes, and it underreacts in other cases where infection and fighting off even cancer can be a consequence of not having been exposed to the right stuff early on.
So this study looked at Amish children and their asthma rates. Now, they had these friendly bacteria, these fellow travelers that we've had through evolution. They were exposed to that. What did we see in asthma rates?
Well, what we saw is that when compared to the Hutterites, which are a very similar religious group that's out west, who have similar lifestyle, similar community, similar religious support amongst the community. But the one difference is that they do industrial farming, whereas the Amish typically have a barn right next to the house. And so there are pigs and cattle and sheep and all kinds of things right next to the house. And the stuff from those animals goes into particulates that then get into house dust. Whereas in the Hutterite community, you don't have barns next to homes. And so what they found was that the asthma rates amongst the Amish were about half the national average, just over half. And for the Hutterites, they were actually a little bit above the national average. And their conclusion was that exposure to Amish dust reduces your chance of getting asthma and other autoimmune disease. They went further than that in that they actually took some dust from the Amish homes in mattresses, and they inoculated mice with them and found that when later challenged with their immune systems, the mice did better when they had inhaled Amish dust.
Now, it seems like we could maybe go too far in either direction. We're too hygienic in some ways. We're not giving our immune systems this exposure. But on the other hand, there are horrible bacteria out there. If we're exposed to them at an early age, we can get diseases. How do we draw the line between enough hygiene to prevent the bad stuff, not too much to prevent the stuff that's going to help us down the road?
Well, unfortunately, we have an existence proof of what works, and it's the Amish. They're very healthy. So without knowing how much dirtier you could get and still suffer no ill effects, you could just point to that as a pretty good balance between too little and too much. So fortunately, we have a guide that says, you know, if you do this, you're going to be healthier.
Talking to Eric Hasseltine, neuroscientist, looking at exposure to bacteria, our immune systems, and mental illness. And let's get into that. So that seems like a big leap, Eric. What does mental illness have in common with something that might cause asthma?
Well, some of the latest research into mood disorders in particular, like depression, anxiety, and seasonal affective disorder, show a strong link between inflammation and those mood disorders. And the causal mechanism is thought to be compounds that the immune system puts out called cytokines that trigger the brain to act depressed. And evolutionary theorists believe that when you're sick, it's a good thing to go away from other people so you don't infect them or get infected. If you have an open wound that's caused inflammation, it's good that you don't go around and get more bugs into it. And so evolution has decided that acting depressed when you have high inflammation is a good thing for your survival and that of people around you. And so when you have inflammation from asthma, psoriasis, arthritis, and so forth, it produces a lot of these cytokines, which can contribute to depression. On the other hand, things that have anti-inflammatory properties also often are antidepressants. The traditional SSRIs, you know, like Prozac, for example, those have anti-inflammatory properties. And a new insight is maybe that's what's helping the depression more than the, you know, prolongation of serotonin in the synapse. So, you know, this is, it's kind of a fad. It's a hot meme right now. And so will it persist? I don't know, but I think there's definitely something there.
So the potential here is that a poorly trained immune system behaves as though it's sick, even though it's not, and causes conditions ranging from asthma and psoriasis, you mentioned, to maybe contributing to certain kinds of mental illness. Am I connecting the dots right there?
Exactly. And it's a double whammy, because on the one hand, if you have an overactive immune system, you get inflammation, like your immune system attacks your joints. On the other hand, if you have a underperforming immune system, you get infection, which also leads to inflammation. So either way, you get inflammation, and you get the effect on the brain, which could exacerbate or trigger or maybe even in some cases cause mental illness. I have been doing big data analysis of, believe it or not, Google search interest in various topics and correlating it with research on epidemiology. And I found, interestingly, that one of the biggest culprits in inflammation called C-reactive protein has almost the same cycle as seasonal affective disorder. And so we have tools now for looking at these effects that we never had before. And believe it or not, Google Trends is a fascinating tool to do that.
Yeah, what would have to be the next step in the research chain to figure out if, yeah, in fact, too much hygiene, bad immune system is contributing to mental illness? What needs to happen next?
Well, I think we need to dive a lot deeper on at least epidemiology. I was able to get only scant data on Amish mental health, and there are a lot of confounding variables. You know, they have strong communities, strong faith, all those things that help your emotional state. But they also have lower rates of mental illness as far as we can tell. So I think increasing the N, getting much higher sample sizes of populations, and then looking not just at the Amish, but looking at the rural-urban gradient is another thing. So I think the short answer to your question is study a lot more subjects.
As far as what we can do with our behavior now, since it sounds like this is probably years away before we're connecting the dots enough to come up with treatments, but are there lessons here for kids needing, you know, more exposure, more proximity to animals?
Yes, research has suggested, and I want to be clear here, that I'm not saying that you should, you know, throw your kid in a pond of muck, you know, and we have to be cautious. You know, these ideas come along and we tend to overreact to them. So I want to caution that,
sure,
that it's not simple, but the following things have been shown to correlate with better immune health. One is having a pet in the first year of life, a cat or a dog or a rat, and having that around the kid. Having older siblings that are going out there and getting a lot of germs or being in a daycare center. Those things. And then, of course, if you're Amish, if you're raised on a farm, being around a lot of animals is generally a good thing. So those are the kind of preventative things that you can do. It's not clear whether there's a kind of critical period or limited window in which the exposure can benefit you. It seems like there might be confined to infancy. But after the kid has gone through perhaps a hygienic environment, there are things that you can do. One of them is to get lots of sunlight. Even dermatologists are starting to realize that there are benefits of UV radiation that they didn't understand before, and one of them is reducing inflammation. Now, I'm not saying you should go out there and get too much sun exposure, but perhaps making sure you get the right amount of sun exposure. Another is getting good sleep and having a very regular cycle, because your immune system goes up and down during the day, and if you get out of whack, like you do shift work or you eat at night or you have a lot of blue light at night to simulate sunlight, you're going to screw up your circadian clock, screw up your immune system, and likely increase the chances that you're going to get a mental disorder. And then, as I said, you know, taking anti-inflammatories, again, I want to caution, there are obvious side effects you have to weigh against the benefit. But just something as simple as aspirin or other, you know, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories could be a route.
Eric, thanks a lot for joining us today. Very interesting.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Eric Hasseltine. He's a neuroscientist interested in body-mind medicine. He talked to us about a link between a strong immune system and mental health, and this is making me feel better about when my kids are little and there's cat hair everywhere and the carpets they're playing on, and I felt guilty. I'm a terrible parent. Turns out I was a great parent.
Right. Same here with dogs and cats and two fish. Well, probably the fish don't come into
it so
much.
I don't know if the fish. So maybe.
But still.
Jury's out on the fish.
Coming up, Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind joins us to talk about the start of the new congressional session, Russian hacking, and more. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. On this week's edition, an unlikely romance between an outdoorsy guy and an indoorsy woman, the trials and tribulations of a marriage plus 8 children, and Peter Sagal distracts himself from the pain of his divorce by running a marathon. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, we've been reaching out to members of Wisconsin's congressional delegations in the lead up to and now the start of the new session. We spoke with Speaker of the House Paul Ryan in December and Democratic Representative Mark Pocan earlier this week. Republican Representative and Mike Gallagher will be on the Joy Cardine Show tomorrow morning and 7:30 to talk about congressional priorities.
When we first put out a call to Democrat Ron Kind of Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, it was to talk about a bill that he's sponsoring to reward healthy behaviors through tax breaks. Since then, a lot of other topics have come up that we wanted to get his take on. We talked to the congressman earlier this morning. Representative Kind, welcome back to the show.
My pleasure.
Let's first of all talk about the House leadership of your party. In the leadership election this week, you did not vote to reelect Nancy Pelosi as the minority leader. Why not?
It was more about Jim Cooper. Jim Cooper is a good friend of mine. I've known him for a number of years. He's a member from Tennessee. He's probably the most decent and pragmatic member that I know here in Congress. And he's shown an ability to find some common ground to get things done. I think we need more of that right now with, quite frankly, the leadership in both parties. But I also think National Democratic Party has a bit of an image problem in the heartland of America. All of our leaders right now are from the East and West Coast, and the 3 top leaders in the House are approaching 80 years old. Is that really the image you want to be projecting for the 21st century here in America, especially for us in middle America?
Are your fellow Democrats taking that issue of leadership being both coastal and aging seriously?
Well, there's been a serious discussion, certainly, after the election, and it will continue in that. But this is nothing against Nancy Pelosi or Steny Hoyer. They are incredibly hardworking individuals and good friends of mine, quite frankly. But I also think the Democrats need to do a better job of connecting with people in the heartland, in rural America especially, where we didn't perform as well this past election. And our policies have a lot to offer people in that area, but you never guess it, because we got to show up more. And the fact that Secretary Clinton did not set foot in Wisconsin once after the primary, I think, was an indication of the problem that she faced at home.
Do you have worries about the Democratic Party here in Wisconsin, in particular, a pretty long losing streak in a lot of key elections?
Yeah, it is, and I am concerned. And I've been working hard with my fellow Democrats around the state what we can do to resurrect the party to be more competitive. But let's not fool ourselves. The Republicans have done a really nice job of stacking the deck against us with the redistricting that they pulled off in the state that loaded up these districts, the voter suppression measures that are making it more difficult for people to participate in elections, the dark money that's playing in the political system right now. All this, I think, needs to be cleaned up and reformed so we have a more accountable and more transparent democracy for the people in Wisconsin.
First week of a new congressional session. Your thoughts on what you've seen so far from a, again, Republican-dominated House and Senate?
Well, they stubbed their toe. The first thing out of the block, they wanted to eliminate the Office of Congressional Ethics. That is not what I was hearing in the course of the campaign last year, that people were anxious to repeal that government watchdog group, one that's in charge of overseeing the Congress, making sure that we're all playing by the rules. And they had to backtrack from that. And they tried doing it, and this is what's really troubling, at the dark of night, the night before the vote was going to be taken, no consultation with the Democratic Party. And when we found out about it, we cried foul. And the media picked up on it, and the phone call started to light up Capitol Hill. And then finally, President-elect Trump weighed in, too, and they backed off from that senseless, silly measure. I hope that's not an indication of what they're going to continue to try to pull here in the days, because there are some serious issues that need to be addressed in this country. We need to be working better together rather than trying to pull these quick one-offs without anyone paying attention.
One thing Republicans did talk about during the election campaign was repealing the Affordable Care Act. It looks like that's still at the top of their agenda. There were some problems there. This was not working as I think anybody had hoped it would. What do you see coming out of this this debate and this possible repeal?
Well, listen, I think they need to be careful. I mean, we're talking about millions of Americans now who are for the first time able to get affordable, quality health care coverage in their life. And not coming forward with an alternative or a plan B, I think, is very irresponsible. Right now they're talking about repealing it, but no replacement. And if they just do repeal, it could lead to chaos in the health insurance market and with premiums for all us Americans. So I think they need to tread with some caution, but also be honest with the American people and recognize that there are good, positive features of the Affordable Care Act that should be preserved. I mean, the fact that young adults now can stay on their parents' plan through 26, the fact that people with pre-existing conditions can no longer be excluded, the fact that there are now lifetime and yearly payment caps, out-of-pocket expenses for all people, are very good, positive features of what was done. And perhaps most importantly, something I've been especially focused on, working with our healthcare providers throughout Wisconsin, continuing the delivery system reform that leads us to a better value or quality-based healthcare system, and also for a better bang for our buck. And that too is something that's happening under the Affordable Care Act payment reform. So we're going to be paying providers based on the quality or the value of care they're giving, and no longer the volume of services that are administered. And that's leading to huge cost containment within the entire healthcare system. So I think if they approach it from that point of honesty, but also recognizing, that, as you pointed out, Rob, that there are some problems with the healthcare reform, that's something we should be able to work together on rather than just using it as a political punching bag.
Talking to Congressman Rod Kind, a Democrat from Western Wisconsin. Big news today, Russian hacking intelligence officials are testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee today. Outgoing President Obama is going to hear a briefing today. President-elect Trump is scheduled to get a briefing tomorrow. How convinced are you that Russian hackers were responsible for all these leaks that we saw from the Democratic Party leading up to the election?
Well, I'm absolutely convinced, based on the briefings that we've been getting too, as members of Congress, and some of the classified information that's been shown to us, and more importantly, the fact that all 17 of our intelligence agencies are in complete agreement with the highest level of confidence that Russia was behind it, and Russia was doing to meddle and try to influence the outcome of our election, and the fact that we got a president-elect coming into office that's choosing his side with President Putin and Russia on this, or with Julian Assange, is astounding to me. I mean, the intelligence community as a whole is some of the most nonpartisan, professional, fact-based people who are risking their lives every day to gather this information across the globe in order to keep us safer and more secure. And for the president-elect to choose sides against them and to align himself with President Putin is astounding to me and extremely dangerous. So I hope that with the briefings that President-elect Trump receives in the coming days, he'll have a second thought about this and think beyond just himself. And I know he's concerned that this might delegitimize his election result, but this isn't just about the United States. This is Russia meddling in all democratic elections throughout Europe, Eastern Europe, anywhere else where we're trying to have fair and free and open elections. And that's his whole goal here, is to undermine democracy, undermine U.S. intelligence agencies so we have little support around the globe. And that just creates a more dangerous world. So I don't know who's advising President-elect Trump right now, but what he's doing is he's choosing sides against the family. And that's never good.
Finally, I want to talk about some legislation you've been working on, the Personal Health Investment Today, or FIT, with a PH Act. What would that do?
Well, it again emphasizes the need for us Americans, all of us, to be more active, to live healthier lifestyles, to eat better, to exercise more. And we do that through the tax code. We spend so much money on health care expenses in the tax code at the end of care when we're dealing with chronic disease management, and very little incentives in the tax code to encourage people to purchase exercise equipment, to join that gym, to be involved in activities that will keep us more physically fit. And we found through studies that the more active people are, the healthier they eat, the less chronic diseases are developed, and people tend to live healthier, more productive lives. And I think there needs to be greater upfront emphasis on overall wellness and health care in our country rather than just trying to treat disease on the back end, which we've been doing for a very long time and spending a lot of money doing it, and we're not getting the type of care that we need.
We'll leave it there for now. Congressman Kind, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob. Happy New Year.
Democrat Ron Kind represents Western Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District, a seat he's held since 1997. He joined us to talk about the first few days of the new congressional session and what he thinks his party needs to do to win back Wisconsin. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Governor Walker called a special legislative session to ramp up the state's response to the heroin and opioid epidemic in Wisconsin. We'll get the latest.
First, when is the last time you allowed yourself to simply do nothing?
If that seems like a scary prospect, well, you're not alone. In a hyper-connected and hyper-active world, we're expected to be on all the time. That can leave us feeling overstimulated and depleted at the same time.
But the opposite, the idea of allowing ourselves to just be bored, it sounds a little scary. Might seem a little dull and depressing even, but our guest says there's an art to being bored. In fact, boredom could help us cultivate curiosity and wonder and lead us to greater self-knowledge.
Eva Hoffman is with us. She's a writer and academic and the author of 8 books, including Lost in Translation and Illuminations. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. Eva, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Hello.
Eva, have we lost the ability to be bored?
Well, I do think we're terrified of it. We are terrified, as you were saying, of moments of inactivity. You know, there were times, there were eras when people suffered from terrible sense of tedium and boredom. And this is not what I advocate. I don't advocate that, you know, that people lounge in a chaise longue all week long in a state of exquisite tedium. To a certain extent, the title is whimsical and tongue-in-cheek. But I do think we have lost the ability to just to have unscripted time, to just let ourselves be without driving our minds or ourselves towards anything, to have to engage in activity which is non-instrumental and non-goal-driven, and of course, you know, to disconnect from all of our digital devices. So we have become terrified of it, and I think it has very deleterious effects.
Yeah, what do you think that we lose when we let go of that capacity and maybe even interest in being bored?
Well, I think that when we move from one activity to another, from one digital click to another, it can feel very exciting for a while. It can make us feel important. But after a while, we lose the sense of ourselves, is the simplest way to put it. We lose our own perspective in all of this. We lose our sense of what we want, what we choose to do, what we desire to do. We also do become depleted. We become anxious, I think. You know, it causes a kind of anxiety. And digital addiction, for example, can have really terrible effects, I mean, akin to the heroin addiction. But the addiction to constant activity or hyperactivity, as I call it, also creates these states of stress and disorientation. We lose the sense of ourselves and the ability to experience our experience, really. And that is a very great loss.
What do you think is actually happening when we have these fallow periods of time when we're not forcing ourselves to think about anything at all and we're not on our digital devices and our mind is wandering as it wants to do? What do you think is going on there that's actually maybe helpful for us?
Well, I think, the mind may be replenishing itself. And also, again, I don't recommend only sitting around in states of idleness, although I think sometimes this is much needed, reconnecting with being in our bodies, reconnecting with our sensual environment, opening, the doors of perception, reconnecting with what is around us, I mean, just very simply, reconnecting with our non-virtual self. But I do think that is replenishing and sometimes creative. I mean, I have a composer friend who tells me that he spends a part of each morning just sitting and staring into space and drinking his coffee and letting thoughts, or in his case, musical motifs, arise as they will. He's a very disciplined artist, and at times he works very hard and he imposes structure on his musical thoughts. But he needs those times, those unscripted times, in order for something to arise from within. But also we need, I think, to replenish ourselves and to nurture ourselves in other ways as well. Let's say by reading, by contemplation of beautiful things, by creative play, etc., etc. And, if we don't, again, we lose a certain kind of energy. I mean, actually, it leaves us, less energized. We lose the energy for being fully engaged in our activities, in our work, in our relationships.
We're talking with Eva Hoffman right now. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. And Eva, let's look at that how part. How can we do boredom right and make sure that we're not just sitting there drooling on ourselves, but that there is maybe something productive and helpful or healing coming out of it?
Well, I think, first of all, we need to give ourselves permission. I think we are afraid of those states in which we don't seem to be doing anything useful or instrumental or clicking on great quanta of information, which actually doesn't add up to anything. So we need to give ourselves permission. We need, I think, perhaps to be disciplined about it, paradoxically, and to say, okay, you know, every weekend I will give a part of the afternoon just to doing what I feel like, just to following my impulses. I think, you know, perhaps we also need to give ourselves time for more structured, for more disciplined introspection. I think we need to connect with ourselves. Because one of the things that gets lost amidst all of this activity is our sense of our inner lives, of our subjective lives, of, you know, those places which are the sources of our desires, of our preferences. So we need, you know, to engage in introspection. We need to give some time to self-knowledge, really. You know, then, you know, activities like reading or, you know, looking at paintings or engage in amateur activities. I mean, you know, no lesser a personage than Winston Churchill made time to paint even during World War II, when the fate of the world was literally, you know, in his hands. And he felt that this was absolutely crucial to his ability to make decisions, to replenish himself. So, you know, we need to understand the value of leisure, which has always been thought of as a kind of foundation of culture.
What do you do to cultivate your own periods of boredom and make sure that you have them and that you're not becoming afraid of it, like you said a lot of people are? What pieces of advice do you have about your own evolving relationship with boredom?
Well, you know, first of all, I would like to say that, you know, it is from my own experience that I understand sort of the addictive force of activity, and particularly of digital activity. I am not an addictive person at all, and I grew up, incidentally, in a culture which had a much slower sense of time and which valued this kind of relishing of experience, because I think cultures used to have very different constructions of time. We don't anymore, I think, in our globalized world. And we are all sort of living in this virtual environment. But I got addicted to the Internet, to email, and had to wean myself from it. But, in fact, you know, I play the piano, which I've always done. I read, and I think, you know, allowing yourself to be immersed in a book is very important. You know, I write a journal, and I think this is also a great aid to self-knowledge and to enriching your internal experience. So, you know, they're perfectly simple ways to do it. It's just that they've become very difficult for us. I mean, it's as if we're becoming de-skilled in absolutely basic human skills, one of which, by the way, is a kind of continuous, spontaneous, three-dimensional contact with other people. And again, this is not, you know, about quality time, which somehow has this kind of very instrumental this tone to it, but, you know, just allowing ourselves to be with other people. It takes time to really enter into the subjectivity of another person, and this, of course, is very important. I mean, it's also very important to cultivate continuous forms of thinking, you know, without which I think our public discourse gets very degraded. And also, if we don't engage with others in a face-to-face way and in a way which, you know, in which we try to understand others, this can also be dangerous.
And we leave it there. Eva, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was writer and academic Eva Hoffman. Her new book is called How to Be Bored. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.